Welcome to the Connections Podcast, a podcast devoted to how Unitarian Universalists of San Mateo connect to our beloved community. I'm Jack Brennan, Connections at UUSM. Today's podcast is brought to you by Justice Circle. Join us on the fourth Wednesday of every month on Zoom to drill down about and discuss recently heard Supreme Court cases. These cases affect our everyday lives, whether you know what's going on or you don't. Stay informed with Justice Circle. Our guest today is Eileen Manning-Villar. Eileen is an attorney and the operations director at Pacific Juvenile Defender Center. She also practices appellate law with an emphasis on juvenile delinquency appeals, taking appointed cases from the First District Appellate Project, the 6th District Appellate Program, and the California Appellate Project, Los Angeles. She's a member of the board of the California Appellate Defense Council. Among her modest collection of published opinions, her favorite without question is In Re T.F., a 2017 juvenile confession case holding that a 15-year-old youth did not knowingly and intelligently waive his Miranda rights due to his age, learning disability, lack of experience in the criminal justice system, and the manner in which his interrogators advised him of his rights. Over the past 3 years, Eileen has been part of the team developing a collateral consequences manual, a record sealing toolkit, and increasing the capacity of defenders in underserved parts of California. Eileen is a graduate of Mills College and UC College of the Law, San Francisco. She's a certified juvenile training immersion program trainer, and she's also my neighbor who lives right across the street from me in Pacifica. Eileen, welcome to the Connections Podcast. I've really been looking forward to sitting down with you just to catch up. Thanks for sending me your professional bio. I want to talk to you more about that, but first, tell me a little more about the pre-professional you. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in several locations. Most recent location was Santa Cruz County in a town called Aptos, and my mother still lives in the same house today. But before that, we lived in locations in California and also in New Jersey, and briefly in Germany, and I was actually born in Big Spring, Texas. So I spent my first year at Webb Air Force Base, where my dad was training with the Air Force.
You got out of there as soon as you could.
My parents both had grown up in California. They were from California. That was a temporary thing, okay. Vietnam War era assignment, and they came back here.
Tell me about your family, however you define that word.
My immediate family is my spouse, Jesse Villar, and my two kids, Shannon and Ellis, and they're both in their 20s. And they've got to live pretty much their whole lives in one house. The house I live in now is, I've been there for 22 years. It's the longest I've ever lived in one place. Before that, we just bounced around to different areas because of my father's work. I still have my mom, and she's down in Santa Cruz. I have three brothers, and they all used to be in the Bay Area, but once moved to Colorado. My family is mostly located in California, even though I'm a Texan.
By birth.
By birth. And I think, I remember when we went back to visit, when my brother was born, he got this honorary citizen of Texas certificate. I was already a citizen, but my brother got to become a citizen honorarily. They probably take that all that very seriously down there. But
yes.
Anyway.
Yes. How did you end up in Pacifica?
My spouse, Jesse, has been a surfer since he was a young person. Mm. And I used to do some of it too, more bodyboarding. We always were living by the coast, and we decided, I think we were over the hill, not that far away, but just decided when we needed to get a bigger house to look in Pacifica and Montara and Pacifica One, which I think was a great choice. It's a very beautiful community, lots of nice beaches, lots of nice people, and still very accessible to the city. And yeah. I love the coast down south. I've always wanted to live there, but like today, you know, there's a mudslide that
yes
is closed down Highway 1. So I think yes. We made the right choice. So here we are, and I've really enjoyed living here.
Yeah, me too. I love this neighborhood too. Okay, another how did you end up question. How did you end up at UU San Mateo?
After my second child was born, Ms. Shannon, in 2000, I started thinking about my other child, Ellis. He was going on 3 years old, and I was starting to think about, I was raised in the Presbyterian Church and thought my kids needed some kind of religious upbringing or just some kind of exposure to it. I haven't been active in a church in many years because I got turned off to religion in college. I went looking for that, and I don't even particularly remember how like I found Unitarian Universalism, but I think I was just looking around and it sounded pretty interesting. So I was going to go to the San Francisco Congregation in San Mateo, and I went to San Mateo first and I liked it. So I never went to San Francisco. Starting in the fall of 2000, I think is when we started. My husband's never been that active. He's come to some things, but it's been great because I wanted my kids to have an RE. What we used to call religious education, now it's
religious exploration.
And my kids are not active now in it, other than they go to family camp, but it's been a really great community for us.
So. I'm so glad. At what point did you know you belonged there? Was that a right off the bat thing, or did it take a while?
I think it was pretty much right off the bat because I didn't go look at the other one. I thought this is a good fit. The leader of RE at the time was Marty Hoffman, and I think she saw me come a couple times and was like, oh, you want to be on our RE committee? And, and that's kind of how I got pulled into it, and it was great. I was on the RE committee for 3 or 4 years, and or maybe longer than that. I was on the RE committee for a while, and that was really what got me in and connected and doing a lot of activities in the family camp. That's the part that keeps my kids still connected to.
Right.
The Unitarian.
You have been lately doing tech stuff. How did that come up?
The tech piece? The work I do at the nonprofit includes learning how to run Zoom meetings. During the pandemic, we had to do our trainings online. They just were looking for people, and I had enough knowledge to make me feel like I could do it, but it's still pretty tricky to do for Gen Zers, like my kids, the brains are very flexible and tapped into it, but it takes me a longer. But I'm still trying. I have to use a lot of tech for my work.
Right.
I really just try to keep up with it as much as I can. I'm actually the webmaster for the nonprofit I work for, and also California Appellate Defense Council, another nonprofit. But I've been the volunteer webmaster for about 5 years.
Nice.
It's partly to keep my brain going and understand this world, and I don't understand it at a very, super high level, but I think it's an important thing to keep tabs on.
Agree. Yeah. So during that time when you were bringing your kids to UUSM, did you do other work in the community? I know you ran for political office and won that. What other kinds of things were you doing in the community?
I was pretty active in UUSM, and then somehow people thought, oh, that looks like somebody who might want to be on this board or that. I ended up being the president of the Pacifica Co-op Nursery School for a year, and then I somehow got pulled into being the president of the Home and School Club at my kids' elementary school, and then I ended up running a parcel tax campaign, and that was in 2008. We were able to successfully pass that parcel tax, which really saved us during the recession. It was a whirlwind adventure that you could do a whole podcast on, and maybe we will do that someday. Just that crew of people. I'm still friends. Stephanie Hamilton was involved in that.
You can ask
her
about
it too. Okay. Anyway, somehow I got in my head, like, I want to do more for the district. And so I decided to run for school board. And they hadn't had a contested election in 10 years. So I thought, at least I could do the service of shaking up the board by having some competition out there. I ran with another parent, Cynthia Kaufman, and she and I ran actually on this kind of on a slate with Marianne Nyhart, who's a local person who was running for city council, and we all three won positions, and Cynthia and I kicked the incumbent out of his position. So We ended up both doing that for 4 years. It was a tricky time because that was the recession, and suddenly the state wasn't sending us money when they were supposed to. And we luckily had the parcel tax money to help, but it was just a tiny part of the budget. But we basically had to juggle things just so we could pay staff. It was a crazy time, but they've had crazy times since then. I know being a school board member now can be a frightening thing, and depending on where you live, I should go to a school board meeting because I actually haven't been to one in a long time. I imagine Pacifica is probably still fairly mild, but you never know. It's a tough job. I don't think in most communities it's a paid position, really. You get a stipend, and it's a tough job. And usually it's a lot of hard work and not a lot of thanks. People will come when they're really upset about something, and then right. You get that. I would get people who would recognize me and thank me. I'd get some of that, but on the whole, it was a tough time as far as the budget went, but the community was very aligned at that time. We didn't have like really big pressing issues come up as far as the culture war type issues coming in. We just had to worry about the state not paying, funding us.
Small things. Okay, back to your juvenile justice work. First, what brought you into that area of the law?
I want to go back to even before the juvenile justice piece, just in general, to talk about the appellate piece. I was looking at doing wills and trusts. I got my patent attorney certification, and I was working at a biotech company, and I just was feeling like I wasn't really doing work that I found very satisfying. I was about to look at other careers besides being a lawyer. I happened to meet a fellow Unitarian at the Labor Day camp up in Mendocino, and his name was Chip Northrup. He was a member of the Davis congregation, and he was a lawyer. I just remember opening up at one of the workshops we had and saying I was struggling with being a lawyer. He heard that and talked to me, and he's like, I do this appellate work. Would you be interested? And he offered to mentor me. And coincidentally, a friend of mine from law school was already doing it and had tried to encourage in me, and I just didn't see it. But between her and him, I just was like, okay, I'll try it. I shadowed him on a couple cases. And from there, I applied to be on the panel. So I have to thank him for really sending me in this initial direction of doing appellate work and actually keeping me in the legal.
I love that so much. I love the UUSM connection to that, you know?
So, yeah, he was a very dear friend. It was very fortunate that came about. From there, I started taking cases from First District Appellate Project, which is in San Francisco, and it's the First District Court of Appeal covers like the Bay Area, coastal counties up to the northern border of California. I was taking both adult criminal and juvenile cases. And they usually start you on juvenile cases because they tend to seem a little less complex. And I was doing some of both. And I went to a local gathering of appellate attorneys, and one of the attorneys who actually works directly for the project came to speak to us. And his name's Richard Brauker. And he did a presentation on why not consider making juvenile law your main interest. He showed a picture of himself back in the day in Tucson, Arizona, standing in front of his marijuana plants and basically driving home the point, which is very true, that we all did things as youth that broke the law in some way or another. I don't think there's one of us who didn't. And it's just a matter of getting caught or what resources you have when, if you do get caught, and who you know, and all sorts of things. I started volunteering with the organization I work for now, Pacific Juvenile Defender Center, too, and then taking more juvenile cases. And I still take some adult criminal cases, but my heart's really on the juvenile work.
How long ago was that when you started with
I started doing appeals around with Chip Northrup, like 2007, I think.
Okay.
And 2006, 2007, and then that was about 2011, 2012 when I started to.
Okay. I looked at the Pacific Juvenile Defender Center website, and they do a lot of different things. all related to juvenile defense work. Can you talk about some of the things they do?
I think people initially think we're like working directly with youth, but we're actually working with attorneys who represent youth in juvenile court. Because a lot of times people don't have the best view of attorneys to begin with. I think they have a hard time wrapping their head around what we do, but you know why it's important. We basically are supporting and training the group of people that represent kids in some of their darkest moments. I mean, hopefully it doesn't get darker before they end up in prison, but to help get kids treated right, treated fairly. Our goal is to get them out of the system as soon as possible and get them into services, get their records cleaned up, all those sorts of things. We do that through supporting attorneys statewide. It started as a volunteer organization, and then they brought on a paid administrator, and I did that for a while, and now I'm an employee, and we now have an executive director. But we're mostly volunteer powered as far as our labor hours go,
because right.
We have some funding, but it's pretty hard to get funding for what we do, again, because I think people think, oh, attorneys, they have resources. But in the state of California, what do we have? Counties, and they all have different systems, court systems, and then their defense systems are all different as far as, I shouldn't say they're all different, but there's many different models. In the urban areas, you've got your typically well-staffed, well-supported public defender's offices, but sometimes those aren't even necessarily well-staffed and supported for the juvenile piece.
Right.
And then in other counties, they have a panel where they have somebody manage the group of attorneys. They have attorneys apply, and then they get appointed by the court. But then even in other counties, they're appointed directly by the judge, which actually is a big conflict of interest, because a lot of times, like, the reason we don't see appeals in many counties is because they don't want to, can I say, piss off the judge?
Yes, you can say whatever you want.
We provide training, low cost to free training, resources like the collateral consequences manual, the sealing toolkit. We have a listserv where people who are defenders can write on either issues or questions, and people will respond from all over the state. We build a community of folks, especially folks who are well-resourced offices, to help support those who aren't and make them feel like they're part of some community. They have some support out there. And actually, during the pandemic, it was interesting because we couldn't meet in person like everybody else. We leveled the playing field for the offices because everybody was at home. So it's like everybody was an independent attorney on some level. There was a lot of good community building at that time. We do things like that. We also do some policy-related work. We work with groups that are trying to basically turn back the terrible set of laws that got enacted in starting the 90s when they were talking about the super predator kids and how they were, these young people are just rotten and mean and ruined forever, and we should clamp down on them because kids do horrible things. Some do, but that's not who they are, in my opinion. A lot of times it's because they're, I think most people in the criminal justice system are not lifelong doing that their whole life. It's more circumstantial, and it's not so much of a psychopathic, sociologic, antisocial type of stuff. It's more their circumstances, and especially for kids, because kids just get together and do stupid stuff. Working with organization with that philosophy is just really important. So that's what we do. Prop 21 was passed in California in the year 2000, and it allowed them to prosecute any kid 14 and older who committed an offense as an adult. Year-olds got sent to prison for life without parole sentences. Kids can now, if they commit certain offenses as juveniles, they can be strikes on their adult record. The thing is juvenile court, you don't have a jury. It's often considered more informal, and you're just in front of a judge. It's like, oh, it's kiddie court, it's not that serious. But California enacted laws, and a lot of other states did as well, that made it more serious. But the kids still didn't have the kind of constitutional rights that adults would have. Plus, they're kids.
With kid brains.
Kid brains. So part of what Pacific Juvenile Defender Center does is just claw back, get rid of these harsh penalties. Now you can't transfer kids to adult court if they're 16 and over. We're just making it more and more difficult. We've been able to be part of a nationwide criminal reform effort. There's some backlash going on now, but just trying to make the system more fair for kids and bring in more resources so that they can get back out of the system.
I'm so glad this organization exists and that you're part of it. Mostly your focus is appellate work. Can you explain to our listeners what appellate work means? We've been throwing around that term today and they may not really understand where appellate comes in.
Basically, appellate work starts at the next level after you've had some kind of matter decided in the trial court. It could be a civil lawsuit, a tort, like a personal injury suit. Sure. Could be family, even a family law, divorce. Sometimes those will go on to appeal. Or, and I think by far most of the work in the California courts, at least, are related to adult criminal or juvenile delinquency cases. Once you're in the trial court, at least in the state of California, if you are convicted or found in the juvenile system, we don't say that they're convicted, they're adjudicated.
Right.
The defendant can appeal it no matter what. They have a right to one appeal. And then the prosecution can appeal it under certain circumstances. Oh. Yeah, there's often rulings that have the juvenile court or the adult court will make, and the district attorney doesn't like it, and they take it up to appeals, and sometimes they win. Oh. I've never done one of those cases. I've always done one where it's the defense side appealing, but they happen.
Okay.
And here in California, it's Court of Appeal is that next level.
Right.
The level beyond that is the California Supreme Court. But you don't have a right to be heard in that court. You can ask, you can petition them. It's like the same as the United States Supreme Court. You can petition for review is what we call it in California. But like in the U.S. Supreme Court, there's hundreds of cases that come in and only a very few are selected. And Chip, my mentor, had one. I got to go see him. It was a restitution case.
Of course, appellate work is a lot of research, a lot of writing. Does it also involve a lot of pressure because of the high stakes of the juveniles who are involved? Is that an extra layer?
There's some pressure, and it depends on the circumstances for the kid, but a bigger pressure gets put on the folks who represent the kids directly and the juvenile court, because what happens in an appeal is often there's not much you can change about, try as you might, and you just have to accept it, and it's the way it is. I've come to terms with that. But I think the bigger pressure is on the folks in the juvenile court. I'm considering going and actually taking cases directly in the juvenile court. Mm. Right now I'm shadowing with an attorney in the San Francisco juvenile court to see if that's something I want to do. So far, it looks pretty interesting. San Francisco has a public defender's office, but they also have a panel of attorneys that take any cases that conflict.
Right.
I should say that any cases that the public defender's office can't take because of conflicts, which usually is like a bunch of kids get in trouble together. They can only represent one kid, and then everybody else has to go to appointed counsel. So I'm looking at doing that.
Oh, I bet you'd be so great at that.
It's pretty intense.
Yes,
to go in there.
It is.
It's something I thought of doing for a while, because sometimes I get frustrated. I'm not trying to be critical of the folks who do the work, but I just feel like I could just do more for the kid if I'm representing them directly. There's just more options. There's just more you can do to help them than appeals are just a little removed. You often don't ever meet your client. You just talk in letters or on the phone. I've met some of them, but typically you don't.
I think you'd be good at doing that. Do you want to share a story about a particularly memorable case?
Sure. Two cases come to mind. The TF case was particularly memorable in that I was able to reverse the charge that the kid had been found to have committed. That rarely happens. And it was a published case. It made some good law.
Yeah.
So that was memorable. But also I had a couple cases where, and on the project, you have an attorney who assigned to you who works for the project directly that you can consult with. I had a couple cases where I saw things to appeal that they, and I would bring them up with them, they didn't really see it. but they didn't stop me from arguing it. So mm-hmm. I did, and I actually won my argument. So I found some weird thing that, and one of them, I was able to reduce a kid's robbery. This was the kid who was in his 20s. I kept thinking of this case as a juvenile case because the kid was pretty young, but he had a couple robbery convictions, and I was able to get one reduced to some type of theft conviction, and that removed a strike from his record. That was when the buddy on the case didn't seem to think I could win that argument, but I was able to show that the kid hadn't put the victim in fear. In this particular case, the prosecution approved their case, and the Court of Appeal agreed with me on that. And then another case was a very young person who'd gotten in trouble as a 12 or 13-year-old for doing a house burglary. Mm. But she was also in the 300 system, that she was in the foster care system. Mm. So had no resources of her own and had a $1,000 victim restitution order against her. I looked at the record, and it took me a while, but I realized that procedurally they couldn't do what they had done. Again, the project didn't really see it, but the person there, she's like, oh, but go ahead. And I won that one. And that one was fun because the Court of Appeal was really mad that I won that. Because victim restitutions, it's pretty tough to win one. And I think a lot of the judiciary and the prosecution, you know, this holy thing. The presumption is really against the defendant once they've got a restitution order against them. But in this case, the kid didn't have any money, and it wasn't even the victim of this particular offense that was pursuing it. It was the probation department. I was able to, you know, wipe that off her record, because what would have happened, it would have sat on her record and she had no money, and it would just, it's 10% interest a year. She would have been out there in the world with this debt that she couldn't pay off. That one I liked as well. And they also got mad at the prosecution for, they were just, I don't know, they were mad that it came to that. They didn't like the way that the other side argued it, and then they were just mad that they had to overturn the restitution. The courts don't like to do that.
I'm proud of you.
So, until the TF case, that was my favorite case. And I still really like that one. I don't know what the young lady's up to now, but right. I'm glad I could help her that way.
Yeah. What else do you want people to know about the work that you and the Pacific Juvenile Defender Center do?
It's really important work. Oftentimes people think, well, these are kids who did terrible things and they deserve to be punished. But again, most of us have done something to different degrees. A lot of these kids are in the system because of circumstance and trauma, tremendous amount of trauma. They come from families where if they have parents, they're working many jobs, they're living a lot of times homeless, other types of trauma, living in communities with sources of trauma, such as just violent crime and around them and those sorts of things. So they've started off life with a tough situation. We're basically filling in gaps for other systems that have failed. Unfortunately, it gets to this point, but we're just trying to get these kids out of that system so it doesn't get worse for them and that they don't end up in the state prison system. In fact, I think we should make our juvenile system go up to age 25, because that's where they see the brain really starts to settle out. I've met a lot of men, specifically in their 40s, who got in trouble as youth, and they were able to get out because the law had changed, and they now go back. They were part of a group of a gang of maybe a drive-by shooting, and they all got in trouble and got life without parole. I've met many, many of them now who now do this kind of work, but more from the working directly with kids to try to keep them out of the system. And they're great. We're wasting a lot of people's lives by sending them to, especially as youth.
Right.
And we need to give people more chances. I know we do need a criminal justice system, but I think it's too punitive. And especially if you're a young person, it shouldn't be punitive. It needs to be rehabilitative completely. That's what we do. The work I do is really informed by our first principle, the inherent worth and dignity, which to me, there's a corollary of, you know, everybody's redeemable. Those are kind of the things that always go in my mind. People do bad things to other people all the time. We need to find better solutions of how to bring it back to how to solve these issues and not just make it about punishment and putting people away for the rest of their lives.
All right, we're going to wrap this up with some quick hitters. I'm going to ask you a quick question. You give me an answer. Are you ready?
Sure.
What's the best nighttime snack?
I like to drink mint tea, and if I have a biscotti around, that's
a good answer. I like that. What's the best advice you ever got?
Get plenty of sleep.
Okay. And what kinds of things keep you up at night, preventing you from following that advice?
Another podcast, but during the pandemic, just everything was keeping me up. The political situation, the last 6 years, everything. I probably listened to too much political talk, so I need to stop. But many things.
What's the most used app on your phone?
I actually have two I use pretty often. One is the YouTube app, and I listen to songs and music on there. And the other one is, I forget the name of it now, but it's one where you can listen to MSNBC and other podcasts and things like that.
But mostly it's MSNBC.
Probably, and I need to, so I'm trying to use YouTube and listening to music more and less of the MSNBC part. I think it's called TuneIn anyway. Mm. So that's my other one. But I also listen to several podcasts on there as well. You can download podcasts.
Good. What's your favorite podcast? Besides UUSM Connections. Yeah.
My favorite is, the one I really, really dig is one called Now and Then, which is Heather Cox Richardson.
Yes.
Do you know that one?
Mm-hmm.
And Joanne Friedman. And I just think they're delightful, the two of them together, and they talk about history. Mm-hmm. The historian, so they bring in this whole current topic and say, oh, well, that's not really new. I love that show, so
yeah,
that's my favorite.
What are you reading right now?
I'm starting to read a book finally that my son gave me for Christmas a couple Christmases ago. It's called Her Honor by LaDoris Cordell, who was a Superior Court judge down in Santa Clara County.
Oh, okay.
She's retired, and she's also does policy work now.
Is it autobiographical, or?
If you'd like, I could let you borrow it when I'm done.
Sure.
I think you'd like it. She's written a couple books. This one is about the issues that she sees with the court systems, both California and more broadly, and how to resolve them. She went to Stanford and did a clinic where she started off doing juvenile cases there.
Oh, interesting.
I think did them before she became a judge. She's got sections on that and just issues with plea bargains. A lot of it's focused on the criminal juvenile end of the courts, but what issues of judge, you know, about judges being elected. There was a recall.
Right.
A judge down in Santa Clara County, she talks about that one. It was related to a rape case at Stanford.
Interesting.
Know how much you would know about that one. But
I love that your son gave you this book. It's always so nice to give a gift that shows that you've been listened to. I love that.
I should read more just books. I read a lot of articles, magazine and newspaper articles online, and a lot of it is doom scrolling, so I need to stop.
Yep.
Stop doing that.
That would be good.
So I'm trying to read more books.
If you had to live in another country, which country would you pick?
I really like Germany. I speak German. I learned that in high school. I have friends there. Some of my ancestors come from there. My mother found our family, that ancestor who came from a little town called Neckarelz, pre-Revolutionary War. Oh. And she's gone back to that town, and this is where her maiden name came from, Emmert. She's gone back to that town and found her relatives who are like 11th cousins or something. But she's gone to the town and befriended all these people, and because she has studied the whole genealogy since they started in Pennsylvania, went through Tennessee, and eventually came out to California. They're distant cousins, but we just spent Christmas with them.
I know you did.
I just know a lot of people there. So culturally, I feel like I wouldn't mind living there, but I don't know. I've never lived there.
Who was the first person you voted for in a U.S. presidential election?
It was Walter Mondale and Geraldine. It was 1984, Geraldine Ferraro. I actually, admittedly, more strongly just remember voting against Reagan.
Right.
I was a big fan of Jimmy Carter as a kid.
Yes.
And
are you still a big fan?
Yes.
I'm still a big fan.
The 76 election was, I was like 9 and 10 years old. So that was like the election I really remember. And my parents were active in local Democratic politics. They did that for many years. And we went to a fundraiser down in San Jose. And I just really was big on Jimmy Carter. And the kids in my school just thought it was so, they thought it was weird anyways, but they just thought that was really weird and they'd make fun of me. But I was too young to vote for him. And then in 80, when Ronald Reagan came along, I was still too young. I was working on campaign stuff. And
right.
I had to meet him in San Francisco, 2006, when his son was running for the Senate seat in Nevada.
Mm.
They came over and there was this kind of funny party at Willie Brown's office. It was a fundraiser. Gavin Newsom was there. And Jimmy Carter kind of got up and spoke a little bit. It was just like this little office and all these people are packed in. And after that, people started leaving and he and Rosalyn hung out. And I went up and told him that story about how I was a fan of his as a kid and everything. And he just was like really, I think he really got a kick out of that because the kids all made fun of me. But I got to meet him. That was like one of my, I didn't know if I really had a bucket list, but that was really something that, anyway, so it was a fundraiser. I found some money and paid to go to this expensive fundraiser so I could meet him. And it was great. I'm very sad about his health is now declining, but I have to really admire that he's just like, okay, I'm just.
Right.
I just think he's such a mensch. He's just amazing person.
What's your go-to order for Mexican food?
I have this kind of funny, I like to get veggie burritos, but then have them put refried beans in them, which just makes them not really veggie, but I think there's lard in them. But
vegetables
I really
and beans, come on.
Anyway.
Okay. What's your favorite local charity?
Besides Pacific Juvenile Defender Center, I really like Second Harvest.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, and those kind of food bank kind of organizations. We donate to, I volunteered for the place in the city that's, I think, the SF Marin. But I donate to the San Mateo County one, Silicon Valley one. I also donate to a couple out in the Central Valley. I send them money too because I think it's like particularly tough out there and less of a donor base than they have here.
Yes. What's the best religion?
I think the best religion is, I'm not going to name a particular denomination, but I admire the ones, to me, the best religions or faiths are the ones that, and they don't have to even be a religion, but the ones who focus on doing social justice work and helping people less fortunate and promoting good acts, as opposed to some religions just seem a little too weirdly self-centered to me. I'm not big on that at all. To me, redemption is about helping other people. It's not about just making an agreement with somebody, may or may not exist. So.
No, I'm with you. Thanks, Eileen. I so appreciate you taking the time to talk to me for the UUSM Connections podcast. This has been really great to get to talk to you this long. I've enjoyed it. Many thanks, as always, to our listeners. Keep making connections.